My pleasure to be back here. Since we are starting this coming week, the Parshiot that will take us to the end of Sefer Bereshit about the story of Yosef, I decided for today that I wanted to provide you with a reader's guide to study the Yosef narrative. That is the reading strategies for decoding the dynamics of the plot of this very complex, multi-layered story, and understanding the dynamic relationship with Yosef in relationship to his father Yaakov and his brothers. When we study Sefer Bereshit, but especially these stories, I think we need to become more cognizant of the fact that our Torah, Hashem, presenting these biographies, the ancient histories of our ancestors, decided to relate our history in a very interesting manner. Instead of presenting our past history in a dry, summary mode with a list of facts and historical information, we are given a very vibrant mode of presentation and communication. We call it the scenic mode. That is, it was told in the mode of a story. It's very captivating. It keeps our interest. It involves us. We call it the scenic mode because when we read these stories, we feel like the scene is as if unfolding right before our eyes, playing out, kivyachol, on a stage right in front of us. It requires a lot of reader participation in order to analyze and assess these stories. There's very little commentary given to us by our so-called divine narrator who presents these stories to us. He doesn't tell us how should we assess the behaviors of the biblical personalities, what lessons and messages should we extrapolate from them. It's as if Hashem allowed the stories to be told, and we need to involve ourselves in the whole reading process. We can't do casual reading if we're going to fully appreciate the profundity and the intricacies of these stories. So I would like to focus today on one pervasive literary phenomenon within the whole Yosef narrative. And that is, while we often think of the Torah as a very compact, brief, succinct text, where there are so many details about the lives of the biblical personalities that we don't know, what is interesting is that within the Yosef narrative, we have the opposite strategy of storytelling. And that is of telling and retelling. We're told the story, and then we're told it again, in a different mode, in a different form, and yet, nevertheless, it's repeated. So on the one hand, we would think this is so beneficial for us, the readers. If you didn't get it the first time, well, you have a second chance. You'll understand it the second time around. But here's the challenge. When we compare the original version with its retold version, and that is that the retelling is not as it seems for two reasons. Number one, if you compare the first story and its retold version, they're not verbatim. They don't line up. Absolutely. There are variations. There are discrepancies in the second version as compared to the first. Change of words, things are left out, things are added in, change of style and structure. Well, now what do we do? Is this really a retelling? or not. The second problem that arises in our reading is that we often get a story which claims to be retelling what is already known, but we, the readers, were not given the original version to be able to make this comparative analysis, to know that indeed what is being claimed to be a retelling is actually that. So we are going to study a number of scenarios, a number of narrative scenes within the Yosef story that are going to demonstrate to us how we have to become better readers, more keen, closer readers, to understanding the dynamics of the Yosef story. But truthfully, these are strategies that you can apply to all stories of Tanakh. And we're going to see especially how our medieval biblical commentators, since I have focused in a lot of my research and scholarship on the Ramban, we will focus on the Ramban extensively, and I will show you how he grapples with these ways of telling the story within these parshiot, and it will give us a better appreciation to understand that our commentators not only focused on getting the basic gist of the story, the general message, the idea, what should we learn from the story, but they focused very intensely and very intensively on how the story is told. Because truthfully, unless you pay attention to the modicum of communication through a narrative, through a story, how did Hashem decide to relate to us centuries later what happened? We really won't fully appreciate what we should eventually learn from these stories. I will also show you how modern scholars who have focused extensively on what is often called the literary approach to biblical narrative have themselves paid attention to this interesting phenomenon of telling and retelling within biblical narrative. And we need to realize that this is a very important aspect of study of Tanakh, and a comparative approach from an academic perspective will sharpen our understanding of the dynamics of these stories. So let's begin. In source number 1 through 3, I wanted to provide you with a little bit of the theoretical backdrop to how we tackle this phenomenon of two versions of a particular story, particularly when they do not align completely. When we have two versions of the same story, but the second version is not a verbatim recapitulation of the first version, even though supposedly it is telling us the same story. So on the one hand, we have the Midrashic approach, and that is based on a text in the Gemara and the Talmud Yerushalmi in source 1. The text bases itself off of a text in Sefer Devarim, which reads, "Ki lo davar rechu mikem." It is not an empty thing for you. But as you were going to see, the Gemara and Masechet Yerushalmi, Talmud Yerushalmi and Masechet Peah, rereads this phrase. Amar Rabbi Mana, "Ki lo davar rechu mikem." V'im rek, v'im hu rek, mikem hu. Lama? She'en atem yigein b'Torah, ki hu chayechem. Ematai hu chayechem? V'sha'a she'atem yigein bo. This Talmudic sage reads, "Ki lo davar rek." There is nothing empty about the words of the Torah. Meaning, every single word in the Torah has intrinsic significance. Every single word is precisely written and calculated to have been communicated because it has its own unique contribution to the larger meaning of this context. If you think that a word in the Torah does not communicate any essential, autonomous, intrinsic meaning, it's mikem. It's because you have not studied hard enough to be able to understand the Torah. Ki hu chayechem, the Torah is your life. And what are you supposed to be doing? Yigein bo. You're supposed to be making a tremendous effort to be able to extrapolate meaning from every single word. Our Spanish Pashtani, our medieval commentators who grew up on the Spanish school of thought of Parshanut, particularly the Radak, who began his life in Spain, moved to southern France, to Provence. He lived from 1160 to 1235. And Ibn Ezra, who is also a product of Muslim Spain, even though he wandered a lot throughout his life. His years are 1089 to 1167. They have a different approach with regard to understanding, especially texts which have repetitions. The Ibn Ezra tells us in source number 2, V'da ki hamilot hem kigufot, v'hateamim hem kenishamot, v'haguf laneshamahu kemo kli. Al ken mishvat kol hachamim v'chol ashon, sheyishmeru hateamim, ve'enam choshashim mishinoi hamilot, achar shehem shavot b'ta'aman. Ibn Ezra teaches us a very interesting insight. From his perspective, words are the body. Meaning, sense, is the soul. Words are the outer vessel, the outer garment. Once you remove them, and you get to the core essence of the meaning, then you have accomplished your goal as a reader of the text. Which means, in an analogous way perhaps we could say, that it is like when you get a wrapped gift. Once you unwrap the gift and you get the gift, what do you do with the wrapping in the box? You just don't pay attention to it anymore. Says Ibn Ezra, that when we are dealing with two versions, and there are changes in the wording in the second version as compared to the first, focus especially on the idea that we need to extrapolate the gist, the essential meaning, the te'amim. The changes in the words, however, should not lead us in a direction that we should think that there are different messages. Just the opposite. They present the same message, just in different words. So he gives you an example that when we learned this in earlier Parshiot, the story of Eliezer meeting Rivka at the well. It is presented to us at great length, narrated to us. And then Eliezer repeats the story when he is trying to convince her family to allow her to go with him to marry Yitzchak. If you line up the two versions, which are supposedly telling the same event, they don't align. The words are different. Ibn Ezra, for example, says, Eliezer says to Rivka, Hashkinina, give me a sip to drink. And when he repeats it to her family, he says, Hagmiinina, give me a sip to drink. And when he repeats it to her family, he says, Hashkinina. Ibn Ezra says, the words may be different, but the ta'am is the same. The key is to focus on the essential message that is being communicated. And therefore, he says, Haklal, in the fourth line, where I underlined, כל דבר שנוי, כמו חלום פרעון נבוכדנצר ואחריהם. רבים תמצא מילות שונות, רק הטעם שווה. We're going to talk about this. Yeah. Ta'am means the meaning, the sense, the idea.
What the words want to say,
right? The general idea, the essence, the meaning, the sense of it, exactly. Even though it's two different words, if they are communicating the basically same idea, well, for him it's the same idea, the same sense, then the different words are like a wrapping that you don't have to worry about, that they are communicating different messages. So we are going to see, for example, Paro's dreams. They're communicated twice. You have to think about this. Our Torah is such a laconic, compact text. And we have so many interesting examples where the same event is presented twice. We are given the story of Paro's dreams in a narrated version. And then when Paro relates them to Yosef because he wants to know the interpretation, it's given to us again in detail. Why didn't it just say, Paro told Yosef his dreams, let's move on? Or Eliezer told Rivka's family how he met her, let's move on, right? But we don't have that. And then, if it's merely a retelling, you would think that the two would absolutely verbatim align, and they don't. So Ibn Ezra says, that's okay. Even though the words are different, hata'am shaveh, the essential ideas are the same. Eliezer would not contradict himself when he just experienced the event. Paro would not contradict himself when he just had the dreams. They're the same. You'll see that Ibn Ezra is commenting, actually, on Shmot Perek Chaf, which, as you know, is the chapter of the Aseret HaDibrot. So Ibn Ezra tells us, in Sefer Shmot we learn, Zachor et Yom HaShabbat. In Sefer Dvarim we learn, Shamo. So Ibn Ezra says, the change in words is not meant to communicate two totally different messages and ideas. In fact, he says where I underlined at the end of this comment, or right before, Hazichira, Kolelet Hashmira. You were commanded to remember what? To remember that on the seventh day you are going to observe. Which means Zahol and Shamol together are really presenting an elaborate, coherent message. Radak in source number 3 has a similar idea. For the sake of time, I won't read it inside because they both agree. So now we need to take these very different parshanot approaches. That of the Midrashic approach, that every single word, if it's changed, we need to focus in on a different message. The change in wording is significant in and of itself. And then we need to take into account the pshat approach of our Spanish Pashtanim, our great Gedolim, Radak Ibn Ezra. No, that we need to not focus in on the changes, but get the main, coherent, cohesive idea. On the other hand, what I have shown you till now are examples where we have both versions. The question becomes, when we don't have the original version, or we will see there's yet another interesting category where we will talk about biblical quotations, which is yet another phenomenon of retelling, which we will get into in a little bit. Let's do one interesting example in source number 4. This is the story of Eshet Potiphar trying to seduce Yosef. Now, we obviously know she fails, and she's in big trouble, because she knows if she doesn't do something to present a version that's going to make her look good, that her husband is probably going to say, off with your head. So she's got to do something fast to preserve herself.
Let's see how our commentators pay attention to the different versions. So on the one hand, we have in source number 4, look in Pasuk Yudet, on a time when there is no one in the household, Vatit Baseo Bivigdol Lemon, she grabs his garment, saying, Shichavayimi, Vayazol Bigdol Biyada. Pay attention to the sequence of events. He abandons his garment in her hand, Vayanas Vayetze Hachutza, and he runs away outside, goes outside. Very interesting repetition. And when she saw that he had left her garment in her hand and he ran outside, drum roll please, she calls the members of her household, and she says to them, look what happened. He brought us this Hebrew man to quote unquote play with us. We will talk about this statement in a little bit. He came to lie with me, and called out in a loud voice. When he heard I was crying out and calling out, notice her repetitiveness show that she's in a state of total panic. Vayazov bigdo et sleep. He left his garment by me. Vayanas vayetzeachutza. So Ramban first of all tells us he was probably wearing an outer garment. He didn't run away unclothed. And he left the garment in her hands because he didn't want to keep pulling it away from her. That would not be very respectful to her stature and status. Nevertheless, he pays attention that the repetition, Vayhi kirota ki azav bigdol biyada vayanas hachutza in Pasuk Yud Gimel, which sounds like it's like a stalling, right? We don't know. The plot's not moving anywhere right now. But that's the whole point. She's putting together what has just happened. She's processing, and she's trying to figure out on the spot, I need to do something quick. Why? Because Pahada, says the Ramban in source 5 on the end of the second line, she was afraid. If Yosef jumps the gun and he gives his version of the story first, she's in big trouble. So hikdimato alehem, she precedes him to them. She concocts the story first. Now, how does she make herself look like she's the victim and he's the criminal? She claims he had already removed his garment. And when he saw afterwards, notice she's changing the whole chronology of events. He had removed his garment first when he saw that she's calling out. He then ran away. And then notice what Ramban tells us. The fact that we have these disparate accounts, notice that here Ramban is taking an approach like that of the Midrash. Change in words is significant. In fact, it is so significant because if you didn't have the original narrated version to compare her concocted version to the people of her household and her husband, you would not realize that she's truly lying and that she's really presenting a whole reworked version of events to protect herself. Says the Ramban, and it is so effective, she only needed to change one word. When our quote-unquote divine narrator, and I use literary terms so that we can understand the different, what we call voices in the text,
You need to pay attention. Stories are told in different voices. Third-person narration, and in the voice of dialogue, where the biblical figures are talking to each other. Most of Tanakh, by the way, in stories, is dialogue. There isn't that much narration, but when there is, and we can compare the two, Ramban says it opens up a whole world of understanding. The original, the narrated version, which we assume, of course, is the authentic version of events, says, Vayazov bigdo biyada. That's because she had grabbed his garment first and he just left it behind in her hand. When she says, Vayazov bigdo etzli, as the Bechol Shol, who is a northern French commentator who did influence the Ramban, I gave you in source 5, even though Ramban never quotes him by name, Vayazov bigdo etzli means, Hesir me'alav le'onsini. He had already removed the garment to rape me. And he didn't have a chance to take back his garment, so he left it by me and slee because I yelled, and he ran away. Ramban says, just paying attention to that change in one word between the telling and the retelling makes us realize how she was very clever in trying to contrive a story of the events that would make Yosef look guilty and she innocent. And guess what? She succeeded because she doesn't get any recriminations, but Yosef is thrown into the pit, right? Into the prison, rather, right? So she must have done something right, at least in her eyes. Now, what's interesting is if you look at the Radak on this source, at the end of source 5, you will see that the Radak does not see a differentiation between the two versions. He says, Vayazov bigdo etzli, ki tefastiv bivigdo le'okivo. That Vayazov bigdo etzli means that I had been grabbing his garment so that he would stay behind until someone would come and take him away, and in the end he managed to reel himself out of the garment and run away. But you notice that what has Radak done? He's merged, as consistent with the approach that I presented about him, he's merged the two versions. In this context, Ramban, adopting an approach to Parshanut like that of the Midrash, has succeeded in unearthing different implications and ramifications with the comparisons between the two stories. And you, for the sake of time, I will not read the modern scholars source 6, but I think it's important for us to realize that modern scholars who have studied about the art of biblical narrative, like that of Robert Alter, who has spread this whole academic approach throughout academic institutions, although he has not necessarily focused on the Ramban, what's important is also that these are issues that that anyone studying Tanakh is very much zeroing in on. So he says in the underlining, because she uses precisely the same series of phrases in her speech that had been used twice just before by the narrator, but reverses their order. So her calling out now precedes Yosef's flight. The blatancy of her lie is forcefully conveyed without commentary. And that blatancy is even more sharply focused through the change of a single word from biyada to etzli. But now look in source number 7. Here's the other example of telling and retelling, where we have the narrated event of the dreams of Paro, and then he tells Yosef his version of the dreams. Now, if you look at a very detailed comparison between them, you will find that they don't align. Not all the adjectives describing the cows are exactly the same. For example, in the narrated version, we learn, where I underline in source 7 at the end of Pasuk Gimel, that these gaunt cows stood next to the fat cows on the river. and that particular detail is not recounted in Paro's version. Or Paro says in Pasuk Yotet about the gaunt cows, Lo ha'iti chahena b'chol eretz Mitzrayim la'roach. I never saw such terrible looking cows. But that particular exclamation is not reported in the first narrated version. Or Paro says in Pasuk Chaf Aleph, Batavona el kirbena, velonada kivao el kirbena, umamehen ra kasher batchila, that when the gaunt cows ate the fat cows, they didn't fatten up, they looked as bad as they looked before, and that particular detail is not recorded and reported in the narrated version. So now what do you do? Sounds like we've got a lot of discrepancies in the details. What really were the contents of these dreams? Now Ramban, interestingly enough, in source number 8, in this particular context, he adopts an approach like that of our Spanish Pashtanim. And he maintains, where I underlined, V'ulay ha-mar'eh v'ha-sipul, source 8, yes? V'ulay ha-mar'eh v'ha-sipul hayu shavim. V'ha-katuv lo yachosh. Meaning, although there are discrepancies between the two versions of Paro's dreams, maybe, and notice a little bit his hesitancy, V'ulay, maybe they're the same. They're commensurate, which means what? Don't focus on the changes in the wording, in the descriptions. Get the general idea, the general gist of the dreams. They're basically the same, despite the changes in the wording. So don't make a big deal about the differences between them. But what's interesting is, he says based on that, V'hakatuv lo yachush. The text is not concerned. What does that mean? Hakatuv is really Ramban's way of expressing what we would call, in literary terms, our divine narrator. Hashem is our author, but he's also narrating the story for us. And Hashem is not concerned. What is he not concerned about? Apparently, what Ramban is telling us is a very important lesson about studying Torah. That the Torah is written in a way that cannot be read passively. It cannot be read casually. What does it mean that HaKatuv, Hashem, writing this story is not concerned? Because he figures you are a very active participant in the reading process. You're a very close reader, and if there are two different versions, he counts on you, the reader, to put two and two together, to take version A and version B and make a synergized, harmonized version C, and he's not worried that you will figure out how to put it all together into an elaborate account of Paro's dreams. Ramban doesn't explain why does he not make a differentiation between these two versions. And by the way, there is a midrashic approach that actually maintains that Paro deliberately changed his version of the dreams when he reported it to Yosef because he wanted to know if Yosef had some divine spiritual spirit or some powers to realize that Paro's making changes here. It was like a test to Yosef to see what kind of powers he really has. But Ramban does not maintain in this context that particular approach. One might conjecture that the reason for that is for two reasons. Number one, if Paro really wanted a genuine dream interpretation, why would he make up things that he did not see? That's not going to get him anywhere, considering he's been so upset that all of his magicians and all of his wise men can't figure out a dream interpretation. Second of all, if you do study carefully which details Yosef focuses in on when he gives his dream interpretation of Paro's dreams, you will see that Yosef focuses on details that Paro tells, that's not in the first narrated version. And Yosef focuses on details that are in the narrated version that apparently Paro did not tell him. Which means that if Yosef is giving one dream interpretation, using details from both versions, they can't be contradictory. So again, I want to sensitize you to start reading biblical stories differently. Zero in on changes, variations, discrepancies, when everything seems to look the same. Let's talk in source number 9. This is a different type of telling and retelling. Here we have, till now we've been talking about two versions, the narrated version and the version in dialogue where the biblical personality is repeating what happened. In source number 9, it's a little different. Here we have Eshet Potiphar, we'll go back to her example. One biblical figure is talking. The same event is being related, but she's talking to two different audiences. In this case, Eshet Potiphar relates her attempted seduction, which she's claiming was an attempted rape, to the members of her household. And then she says the same story later on in private to her husband. But what's interesting is the two speeches, telling, retelling about the same event, they don't read verbatim. Look in source 9. When she calls out to the people of her household, she says, "Re'u hevi lanu ish ivri litzachek banu, ba elai lishkabimi." See that a Hebrew, he has brought us a Hebrew man to play with us. He came to me to lie with me. But I called out in a great voice, and a loud voice. But to her husband, in Pasuk Yud Zayin, she says, "Ba elai ha'eben ha'ivri asher hebeta lanu letzachek bi." Now you see, the gist is the same, but look at the change in style. The Hebrew servant came to me, whom you brought us to play with me. The style is completely different. So what's interesting is that Robert Walter, in his studies on this particular scene, as well as other modern scholars, and I think it's important to see the juxtaposition, but how to read these stories differently. He says the following. Her story in source 10 to the household servants cleverly enlists their sympathies against the foreigner, who constitutes a sexual threat and an insult to them all. He's understanding litzachek as to dally with, as well as to mock, and is meant to incite them against the husband who has introduced his dangerous alien presence in their midst. Notice this reading, and this reading is echoed by a number of other scholars. She is accusing directly, even though she doesn't name her husband by name, right? She's accusing her husband directly of bringing a dangerous alien into their midst, purposefully, litzachek banu. When she speaks to her husband, however, she's a subtle mistress of syntactic equivocation. She has a studied rearrangement of phrases. In her words to the servants, the husband had unambiguously brought the Hebrew to play with us. But when she repeats the whole short clause in direct address to her husband, she places it in a way, I'm in the middle of Sor 10, she places it in a way it could be read in two ways. Either, notice we don't have punctuation in the Tanakh, so we have to put the punctuation in. Either you could read, Ba'elai ha'eved ha'ivri, kama, asher hebeta lanu, kama, litzachek bi, which is a more muted type of accusation. The Hebrew slave came to me, who you brought to us, to play with me. Or it could read, Ba'elan elai ha'eved ha'ivri asher hebeta lanu. This Hebrew servant came to me whom you brought, right? Litzachek bi, that you brought him deliberately to play with me. The second reading is a sharper rebuke, suggesting he had perversely invited trouble by introducing such a menace into the household. But she's cunning enough to word the accusation in a way that he could take it either way, either as a more mild rebuke or as a more direct scathing one. Ramban grappled with these same issues. How does Ramban understand this? He says, in source 11, if you look in the second quotation, he says that really we are dealing with a mikra mesoras, an inverted expression. What does that mean? Even though the style of her speech to her husband looks different as compared to the style of her speech to the household servants, and one might think that you should read a different message and a different tone in her speeches, says Ramban, no. Just take the statement that she makes to her husband and invert it and make it read very similarly to that she said to the household servants. Why doesn't Ramban take these stylistic divergences, these rearrangement of phrases, and read different messages into each speech? Because he maintains that if she wants to make herself look innocent, the best way to poke holes in a lie is to give two different versions of your story. Because then someone says, well, wait a minute, you said version A to the servants, you said version B to the husband, you're obviously lying because you can't even get your own story straight. So says the Ramban, she must have, despite the stylistic variances, she must be saying the same thing. Besides the fact that he emphasizes that the main point of her speech is to present a coherent accusation. And her coherent accusation is, as I underlined in source 11, Hine asa imanu ra'a lehavi beveitenu ivri ve'asao paki ve'nagid ve'ra'ui lo sheyitzachek banu ve'ze tam asher hebeta lanu ki ahavato beveitam hayata kasha be'eneihem. In the first reading, we had seen that to the household servants, she is directly accusing her husband of bringing a dangerous menace and alien into the midst. Ramban apparently thinks to himself, well, that's going to cause the servants to rebel against the master. What is she going to achieve by that? That is the worst possible scenario that she could be creating. Bedafka, the opposite. She wants that the servants and she, not that they should align against the husband, but they should all be aligning against the perpetrator, Yosef. How is she going to accomplish that? Because she's telling both the servant and her husband that Re'u hevilan, what is the object of the verb to bring? He brought him into the household. He's an ish ivri, he's a foreigner. And look what he did. He made this individual a supervisor, an administrator, pakid v'nagid. And unintentionally, now look what Ramban did. He added on two words. The text just says litzacheg banu or litzacheg bi. Ramban adds on two words, v'ra'ui lo sheyitzacheg banu. Unintentionally, our master Potiphar, by elevating this foreigner who's only supposed to be working in the fields and not in the house, certainly not as an administrator, unintentionally, he made this individual, you'll say, think that now he can lord it over us and he can mock us and he can be a menace to us, i.e., it really was the initiative of Yosef, so it's putting more of the accusation on Yosef. But then again, the husband is guilty unintentionally. So once again, although we have seen that Ramban sometimes does read significance into changes between versions, on the other hand, Ramban also allows himself to take each context, each scene separately into consideration, and then to decide, should I read significance into the changes, or should I harmonize and merge them, because by doing that approach, I will better elicit an understanding of the dynamics of this particular narrative scene. Let's move on to another example, a very interesting phenomenon when we talk about telling and retelling. And that is quotation. Think about it. Someone X says something to Y. Z quotes Y, right? Or Z quotes the original version. When we talk about the word quotation, which is why we're all told to put quotation marks, right? We assume a quotation is an authentic, verbatim repetition of what was originally said. Well, here's an interesting thing in the stories of Yosef and other places in Tanakh. There is a lot of quotation, but it's not so simple. Because number one, we have two categories of quotation. There's what one modern scholar, George Savran, has classified verifiable quotation and unverifiable quotation. What does that mean? Verifiable quotation means you have the original speech and you have the quote. So you can compare if the biblical figure is really actually quoting what he claims to be quoting. Then you have unverifiable quotation. What does that mean? Somebody is claiming to be quoting, but you don't have the original speech to verify that he's actually quoting what was originally said genuinely and authentically. What's interesting is even when you have verifiable quotation, it doesn't always match up either. They're not verbatim. And now what do you do? So let's look at an interesting example. When the brothers are accused of being spies in source number 12, Yosef decides, remember, they think he's an Egyptian minister. Yosef decides he's going to be quite magnanimous, and he's going to let them go after imprisoning them for 3 days. Because he says, Eta Elohim ani yare, I'm an ethical individual. So he says in source 12, in Pasuk Yotet, if you really are trustworthy, im kenimatem, leave one brother, apparently Shimon, back in prison, and the rest of you just go home and bring food to your family. And bring me the youngest child, and then I will know that you're trustworthy. Velo tamutu, and you won't die. So they go back to Yaakov, and they tell the story to Yaakov, because Yaakov wants to know what happened. And in Pasuk Lamed Gimel, they say, Ha'ish Adonai Ha'aretz said, if you are trustworthy, now notice what they say, Achichem Ha'echad Hanichu Iti. You already see there are changes. They don't say that Yosef said, leave one brother in prison. They say that to Yaakov, no, the Egyptian minister just said, leave one brother with me. Hanichulti, iti, as if he's going to be fed like a royal, in the royal palace, right? He'll get royal treatment. Hanichulti, just leave him there. They already are changing things. And take home your food, bring the youngest brothers that I will know you are not spies and you are trustworthy. Notice they leave out Yosef's threat, velo tamutu, and you will not die. But then they are on something very strange. Ve'et ha'aretz tishar, and you will be able to trade in the land. Yosef never said that, at least in the version that we have. But they claim to be quoting Yosef. Already we see, with the issue of leaving the brother behind, that they changed the wording around. Should we make a big deal about that or not? And now what do we do about this additional caveat? So interestingly, in source 13, I'll do it by heart because I'm running out of time. Interestingly, in source 13, Ramban gives us two possibilities. First of all, understand that when he understands Et Ha'aretz Tishar, even though there's a question about the actual version in the Ramban, he says it means that I will not take either customs taxes from you when you want to bring your merchandise, or I won't even ask you to barter. I'll give you the grain for free because I want to show that I'm ethical. So if you bring the youngest brother back, I'm going to show you how magnanimous I am. But he understands tisalam in a very specific sense is to trade, do business. You'll be able to do business in the land if you prove you are not spies. What do you do about this additional caveat? So Ramban says, alternative one, shinula badavar mitnei ha-shalom, kedei shishma lehem lishalach otam itam binyamin. Meaning, they made this up. They added on something that Yosef never said in order to placate Yaakov so that he would let Binyamin go, because Yaakov's been stalling for a long time and they're running out of food. And notice Ramban says this coheres with the fact that they conveniently leave out their own imprisonment and the fact that Shimon has been left behind, not being given royal treatment, but he's actually in prison. So they, listen to the language, shinula badavar mitnei ha-shalom, they changed things in order to placate Yaakov. But what's interesting is because of the fact that we are dealing with a very interestingly dynamic and ambiguous text, Ramban gives us a second possibility. V'yitachen, and it's possible, she'amar lehem Yosef be'et ha'aretz tischaru. Maybe Yosef actually said it. Ve'lo sipero hakatur. And the text didn't tell us originally. Because the text counts on us, the readers, when we hear it being said by the brothers, we will put two and two together and realize that it was originally said by Yosef as well. Now, if you pay attention, the Chizkuni, who was a 13th century French commentator, and most Pashanim, like Rashi, who is quoted by Ramban, they make a decision. Either Yosef said these words originally, or he didn't. Chizkuni actually says, no, Yosef lo amar lahem kein. Yosef never said these words, ve'et ha'aretz yischaru. The brothers appended this to their original quote-unquote quotation. But Ramban does not make a decision. He leaves us readers in a quandary. He gives us two very different possibilities. A, Yosef didn't say them. B, Yosef really did say them. Well, which one is it? It can't really be both. But Ramban says it can. Because the text is ambiguous enough that it leaves open these two viable possibilities. Because if Yosef really did say these words, it fits in with the fact that he's trying to be ethical, and he's trying to present himself as a magnanimous individual. It fits with the persona of Yosef. If Yosef did not say these words and the brothers are contriving them, it fits in with the fact that the brothers are trying to persuade Yaakov. Meaning what? The first reading that it's contrived focuses on which dynamic of this scene? On the brothers focused on Yaakov and trying to placate him to let them fix the situation. The second reading focuses in on whom? On Yosef and the type of persona that he ultimately wants to present to the brothers. So Ramban says, I leave you, the readers, to decide. Both possibilities are viable because each possibility focuses in on a different dynamic of the story. The relationship with Yaakov, the relationship with Yosef, the Egyptian minister. The same ideas in source 14. When the brothers don't go anywhere, and eventually things don't work out, and ha'ra'av kaved ba'aretz, and famine is getting worse, and they plead with Yaakov to let them take Binyamin, Yaakov says, what did you do? Why did you even let this Egyptian minister know that you have a younger brother? And so they say in 14, where I underline, Sha'ol sha'al ha'ish lanu lumada ladetenu lemo, ha'od avichem chai hayesh lachem ach. The man, Yosef, asked about our family. Do you have another brother? Is your father still alive? We'll go back to the entire discussion that Yosef had with the brothers, pretending to be a minister. Yosef never asked it. He never asked. Now, Ramban once again leaves you with two possibilities. It's hitnatzlu l'avihem in source 15. They are making excuses before their father. They're covering up. So they're claiming Yosef asked something that he never asked. Or maybe Yosef really did ask it, because if you look at the long discussion that the brothers have with Yosef, they seem to be tripping over their words. Where we come from, we're 12 brothers, we have one father. There's a very lengthy discussion, right? And the one of the brothers is not with us. Maybe within that whole discussion, somehow Yosef also asked about, is there another brother? Because later on, Yehudah in Parashat Vayigash, one of his main ways of trying to get Binyamin back and substitute himself for Binyamin, he says, Adoni sha'al et avadav lemor, hayesh lachem avoach. You asked us if we have a brother. So we brought you the brother. It's your fault. Why are you blaming us? Take me as the slave instead of Binyamin. Well, Yehudah would not be blatantly lying in front of Yosef. You asked us when he never asked. And yet, despite that fact, that apparently Yosef asked, Ramban still presents you with the first opinion. No, he never actually asked, but they were trying to, right, defend themselves before their father. Once again, notice the interesting tension in how to read a narrative scene when you're dealing with so-called quotations. In the last example, in sources 16 and 17, the brothers claim to Yosef after Yaakov dies, our father said, forgive us. They told us to tell you that you should forgive us, as they were afraid, now that Yaakov's dead, that Yosef will start recriminations against them. So Ramban says, that is completely levadot milibam. They made this up. Yaakov never said anything like that. Because if that's the case, they would have told Yaakov to directly go to Yosef and talk to Yosef himself. You know, leave the brothers alone. Yaakov never said anything, because Yaakov never knew that Yosef was sold in the first place. But the brothers, notice the language in source 17. Levadot milibam dvarim. They made it up in order to try to get Yosef, not to punish them, because that's what they think is now going to happen. And they're claiming to be quoting what Yaakov said, when Ramban says in this case, unequivocally, Yaakov never said it. So I hope that I have sensitized you today to a different way of focusing on the dynamics of reading the Yosef story, which, as I said, can be applied throughout Tanakh. Think about when you have two versions of the same story, when they don't align, when they're not verbatim. How do you compare and contrast them? What should you extrapolate from them about the whole understanding of the plot and also the dynamics of the relationships between the biblical figures? Think about it when they claim to be quoting. Look for quotations. I'm going to sensitize you now. You're going to start looking more for quotations and the dynamics of dialogue and how the interactiveness between the biblical figures and the way it is communicated to you in these stories, if you focus in on how the story is told, you're going to open up a whole world of understanding about the message and meaning of these stories for us. Thank you.